Are you looking to connect with a diverse audience of developers? Look no further. You can partner with us here at the Code Newbie Podcast, and we'll help get your message out to our incredible listeners in an ad just like this one, led by me, your host. Contact us by emailing sponsors@codenewbie.org. Welcome to the Code Newbie Podcast, where we talk to people on their coding journey in hopes of helping you on yours. I'm your host, Saran, and before we kick off the show, I want to tell you about our incredible sponsors. Today on the show, I'm so excited to have Director of Engineering at Postlight and founding editor of Lifehacker, yes, the Lifehacker, Gina Trapani. Gina, you want to say hi?
Hey, thank you so much for having me on today, Saran.
Thanks so much for being on the show. I was so excited when we connected via Twitter a little while ago, and I said, oh, I'm totally going to get her on the show. This is my chance. And then I went for it, and it happened. So I'm very excited.
I'm feeling very lucky.
So you've done a bunch of really, really cool stuff. You are the founding editor of Lifehacker. You currently got a new position, director of engineering at Postlight. You made this awesome site called MakerBase. You're also a founder of ThinkUp, and you've done just a bunch of other stuff. So we have a lot to get through in the short time that we have together. Are you ready?
Let's do it. I'm ready.
So let's start kind of at the beginning-ish of your career with Lifehacker. So for people who may not know what Lifehacker is, tell us a little bit about it.
So Lifehacker is a blog about software and productivity. I was the founding editor back in 2005, and that was back when the phrase life hacks was new, and it wasn't kind of, you know, a meme the way it is kind of today.
Do you get to take credit for life hack? Do you get to take credit for that word?
I don't. Aww. And I want to give credit where credit is due. And I think this is really important in general. But Danny O'Brien, a gentleman named Danny O'Brien, who's very smart and I believe is still at the EFF, he coined the term life hack in a conference talk he did at ETEC, which is an O'Reilly conference back in 2004. And then we ran with the idea with Lifehacker, as did other productivity bloggers like Merlin Mann of 43 Folders. So I did not coin the term.
Okay.
But I ran with it for sure.
So tell us how Lifehacker got started.
Well, at the time I was working as a developer for Nick Denton, who's the founder of Gawker Media, which Lifehacker was a Gawker Media site. I was working as a developer on a project that he was working on called Kinja, Kinja 1.0. Kinja has since been kind of revived into a 2.0 commenting system for the Gawker sites. But I was working on Kinja 1.0. This is back in 2003, 2004. And Nick and I had gone out to lunch to talk about Kinja, and he said, you know, I registered the domain name lifehacker.com. And this light bulb just went off in my head. I was like, that was available? That's amazing. That's going to be a great site. Because, you know, at that point, Gawker existed and Gizmodo existed. Mm-hmm. And so I knew what he had in mind. And I just started kind of spouting off ideas for posts, things I thought the person who was going to write that site should write about. And he just kind of smiled and listened. I don't remember how long after it was, but he said to me, hey, would you like to write this site?
Wow. That's fast.
At the time, I was writing a personal blog because this was kind of like in the early times of blogging. And I was writing a personal blog, a way too personal blog, by the way. It was kind of back in the days of, you know, LiveJournal and Blogger and all that. And I was in my early 20s and it was all TMI. But Nick, you know, Nick enjoyed reading my personal blog. And he said to me, I know that you can write, even though you're a developer, I know that you can write and you've got all these great ideas. Like, what you know, would you consider being kind of a pro blogger, a full-time blogger. Huh. And that idea was just so interesting to me. So it was pretty fast. I think that Nick kind of had the idea and was holding the domain. I don't think he had like a launch date for the site. I think that he was just kind of like, let's see if I could find the right person for this. And so I'm indebted to him for taking a chance on me like that.
So when you decided to do Lifehacker, was it supposed to be the same type of really personal blog posts and journals as what you were doing, or what was the big shift?
No, not at all. It was going to be more like Gizmodo, which was this monstrous gadget site, a site about gadgets and electronics and tech, but it was supposed to be the software version of Gizmodo with an emphasis on kind of productivity and getting things done. That book called by David Allen was enjoying some popularity at that moment. And when I decided that I wanted to do the site, I felt very strongly that there are lots of tech blogs. There was the Slashdots of the world and Gizmodo and Engadget. And they felt to me very gadget focused and also just very male. And it was just kind of this culture of like worshiping shiny things for the sake of shiny things being shiny. And I wanted to do the opposite of that. I wanted the voice of Lifehacker to be helpful and not snarky, which is very unusual in the Gawker stable. And I wanted to be about the fact that technology exists to make our lives better, not for us to worship it or covet it or just kind of use it as a status symbol. Mm-hmm. It's supposed to help us make our lives better and easier and help us get things done. And so that was really appealing to me, the idea that I could create. And the original Lifehacker mascot was a woman. So I liked the idea of having sort of a big tech blog that had a different kind of voice and a different sort of emphasis.
So with this different focus, different direction, with it being, you know, a little bit more feminine, it sounds like Gawker Media was also taking a bit of a risk, right? Because they were doing something that was very different, where tech was very gadgety and very shiny. How did you feel about that risk? Were you worried or concerned that people wouldn't connect with that content?
You know, I didn't really think about how the audience was going to take it. I thought more about the fact that I was not a professional writer. I had never been a professional writer. And it felt like I was just going into something. I was more worried that I wasn't going to be able to handle the responsibility than the audience sort of not. I mean, of course, I worried about the audience kind of being responsive to it. But we could see that Life Hacks was becoming a thing, a force, a meme, a thing that people talked about in a certain way. So I had confidence that the content was going to be good and people were going to like it. But I was worried about, you know, was I the right person for this job?
Mm. At what point did you realize that you were the right person for this job?
I'm not sure if I ever realized. It took me a long time. It took me, I would say a year to a year and a half before I felt really comfortable in my role at Lifehacker.
Really?
It was very uncomfortable for a very long time for
me.
Yes. Yes. You know, Gawker is a very big blog network with tons of traffic, and Lifehacker was very high profile from day one, since the day we launched. And part of that had to do with we had launched with this sponsorship from Sony. And at that time, big brands like Sony sponsoring blogs was virtually unheard of. So there was a lot of blowback about that, about how, you know, we were selling out and blogs were getting corrupted. So there was an article in the New York Times and Adweek, you know, Ad Age, the first day that we launched. So I felt very, very vulnerable and very, very exposed. And I saw people commenting on my, you know, writing style and the voice and I was getting a lot of critical feedback and a lot of appreciative feedback. But of course, the criticism is always like 100 times more amplified in one's mind than the good stuff. So yeah, I felt very vulnerable. There were tears. I was pretty sure I was going to quit soon, but I didn't want to do it too soon because I don't want people to think that they had actually gotten to me. It was a lot of that.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was pretty tough. It was pretty tough. Being a high-profile blogger, particularly like a sole blogger at a site that's getting, you know, hundreds of emails and comments a day, it's a lot. It's a very fast education and building a thick skin.
I feel like a big part of that might have also been the fact that you were just doing it alone, right?
Yes.
And even with, you know, something that is not nearly as high-profile as, you know, Lifehacker with just this podcast, it's, you know, me making the decisions on who to interview and what to ask and who to talk to and just kind of hoping that I made the right decision and hoping that people like it and, you know, hoping that it's still on brand and, you know, on message and still helpful. And so just being the one entirely responsible for the editorial direction of your project was probably, you know, a big part of it.
Definitely. And 9 months in, it was very clear that I needed to hire someone. I wanted to work with someone else. And later on in my career, down into my career, when I decided to start a company, starting a company without a co-founder wasn't an option.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to have at least one partner. So it was a good, that was a good lesson for me.
Mm-hmm. So you ran Lifehacker from 2005 to 2009. So it's been a while. What do you think of the site now?
Oh, I love that the direction of the site has gone in. When I left, my best writer and a good close friend of mine took over, Adam Pash, as editor-in-chief. And when I left, I said to him, Adam, take this site and do all the things, make it yours, do the things that you think, you know, we should have done a long time ago and I didn't do, take it farther than I ever did. And he did. Mm-hmm. And now we're kind of like three or four generations of editors into Lifehacker now. And I love what they've done. I mean, of course, they're part of the Gawker network, and Gawker has been going through some things recently as a company. But as for the site itself, I think that the Life Hacks kind of meme and the idea has kind of cooled and is kind of a little more old news. And I actually saw a bit on like Conan and Brian a couple weeks ago, a Life Hacks bit that was just it was a joke. I mean, my local coffee shop was like, you know, had a little blackboard out front that said caffeine, you know, life hack, and seeing that kind of stuff is just so weird. It really is. I mean, BoJack Horseman, which is this show on Netflix, they had a life hacks joke in it. So That kind of stuff just blows my mind, because back in the day, it was a very, you know, when I first started, no one had ever heard of it. When they did, it was like, oh, this is so cool. Mm-hmm. So that's been really cool to see. But I've been really happy with the direction the site has gone. It has grown incredibly, and they've done video series and a podcast, and the art has gotten better, and the coverage has gotten better. I've been really happy about where the site has gone.
So if Life Hacks is old media, what's the new media of Life Hacks? Is it like Twitter Moments? Like what's the new age way of doing it?
That's a good question. You know, after I left Lifehacker, I was really just burnt out from blogging. I was, you know, I was editing or writing, you know, 12 to, you know, a dozen to two dozen posts a day for 4 years. And I just didn't have any more words anymore. And I took a break for a long time from writing. And since then, so many things have changed. You know, I don't know that someone starts a blog these days the way that I started Lifehacker, even my personal blog. I think that you write on Medium. I think that you do Snapchat stories. I think that you live on Facebook or Twitter. I think that the mediums are, or you do a YouTube channel or a podcast. It's been so cool to see the podcast medium blow up the way it has. So the mediums are changing. And I think the memes are the hot ideas of the moment. It kind of depend on your community. I don't know what the kind of new hot idea in tech is. I'm sensing some burnout around like try all the apps. than there was back in 2005.
So blogging is something that we talk about a lot on the show and in the community as a way for new coders to showcase their talent and what they're learning and what they're excited about. What are the life hacks that you might have for some code newbies who are putting together their own personal blogs to showcase the code that they're learning?
Well, one thing that I've been doing, particularly at my new job, is I've been keeping a work journal. I wrote publicly for a really long time at Lifehacker, and so every word I published, you know, thousands of people were seeing, and that's like both a privilege and also can be a burden. And so what I started to do at my new job, because I'm working with a lot of different clients, and I think this is similar for someone who's just starting to code and learning a lot of different things, is I'd be keeping a private work diary of like, today I learned kind of stuff. Notes on things that I'm working on, stumbling blocks. I keep a yay me tag of like, hey, here's something I accomplished today.
Oh, that's awesome.
So, yeah, having that kind of private repository of just notes to self that you're not worried about someone else. You're not worried about composing it so it reads really well. Mm-hmm. It's just for you. I think that kind of base of notes can really inform, you know, the stuff that you do want to publish. So if you do want to keep a blog to showcase your projects, I think it's good to start with just writing privately, because that takes all the pressure of people looking, you know, you can just brain dump and not worry if it sounds great. And then when you're ready to showcase, you can go back to your notes and draw from those notes and then publish that.
That's a good idea, because I think that as soon as you say a future employer is going to see this, it puts all kinds of pressure on you, and you know, it creates all this anxiety that is not very helpful, and it's, you know, not a great thing to have in the back of your mind as you're trying to express yourself and gather your thoughts. So I like this idea of a personal work journal.
Absolutely. It's helped me a lot.
Mm-hmm. So after you left Lifehacker, what happened next?
You know, I made a decision to leave Lifehacker several months before I actually did. I had to save up some money and really summon the courage to leave what was an incredible job that I absolutely loved and that I got a lot of recognition for. I published 3 books. I was, you know, I was on the radio. I was on TV. I mean, it was a fantastic job doing a thing that I loved and creating a thing that I loved. But I got to this place where I was like, I've done everything I can do here, and I really missed coding. Because I was spending all day writing, I didn't have time to code. So I saved up a bunch of money, and I left without really having another job. Having a partner who was employed was very helpful in being able to make that move, and I'm very, very grateful for that. I was privileged to be able to do that. And so I left Lifehacker, and I started working on some personal coding projects, and then I kind of just hung out my, you know, freelance shingle and just started trying lots of different things. I started podcasting for the first time on the Twit Network, thanks to Leo Laporte. I did a video series for Fast Company, which was wonderful until I had to actually watch myself in the videos. That is
How is that?
Terrible. Oh, terrible.
I had to watch I think it was like a 10-minute interview that someone did at OSCON when I gave the talk about luck and privilege. And I was really excited to watch it. And then I watched it and I said, why is my face like that? It's wrong. Fix your face. Fix it. Yeah. It's so awkward.
It's inescapable. And, you know, the people in my life who are so incredibly successful will have like something like that, like a talk or a presentation. And they'll say to me, like, I had a very close friend of mine is very successful, who did a thing I admired very much. And he said to me, I cannot stand looking at that picture of me on that stage. He's like, I can't. It kills me every time. And it was, you know, I felt terrible that he was feeling that way. But I really was like, oh, thank goodness. This is a universal experience.
Yes, because you notice that you do weird things. Right? Yes. When you watch yourself, you're like, for me, one of the things that I do that I didn't know I did is when I gesture, my version of a straight hand is me bending my fingers all the way back. And it looks really weird. It looks really, really, and I'm looking like, why are your fingers that way? Your fingers look broken. So that's my thing.
There, you know, we do a YouTube version of This Week in Google is a show I do on Twit, and they publish it's live streaming video then to tape, and then they publish the videos on YouTube. And YouTube hates me because the still for the show is always like a still of my face. I'm like mid word, and I just look either high or asleep or like a serial killer. Like it is never an attractive still of me. So you should go to the Twit channel on YouTube, and you can make fun of the shows that I was on. I'm only on once a month now, but the shows that I was on every week, it felt like every month at least there was one terrible still of me automatically chosen by YouTube.
That's awesome. You can't control the still?
I think that you can. Maybe Twit is to blame for this. I don't know.
Yes,
I have
let's
to ask
blame
them.
Twit. Let's blame Twit. Yes. Okay, so you did the freelance thing for a while. You did a bunch of what sounds like really awesome and fun projects. And what I love about it is you've done a combination of media things and storytelling, but also technical stuff. Which one is your favorite?
Yeah, you know, I really go back and forth. Currently, I really enjoy building software, and that's why I have my current job. And I love to write and I love to speak, but I like those to be byproducts of building things. Mm-hmm. So at that time when I was freelancing, I was writing for some magazines. Because at this point, you know, I was off Lifehacker and people knew me as a tech writer. So I had a lot of great opportunities kind of in media. But in the meantime, kind of on the weekends and nights, I started building. I was fascinated with Twitter at the time. So this is 2009. And the Twitter API is very open and very cool. And people are really excited about it. Twitter is just starting to gain momentum. And so I started building a thing that I decided to call, unfortunately, Twitalytic, which is a Twitter
That's an
analytics
awesome name.
I know. It's a terrible name. It's a terrible name, but I appreciate your kindness. Terrible name.
That's a name that I would come up with. That's why it makes me so happy. I would be like, guys, we're gonna call it Twitalytic.
Twitalytic. It was not a branding effort. It was literally just like, I need a name for my GitHub repository, so let me just call it that. But Twitalytic is what eventually became ThinkUp. And Anil Dash, who was my co-founder at ThinkUp, and we were friends from online, from blogging friends, and it became real life friends. And he sent me a pull request on GitHub, and I said, oh, that's interesting. And then he said to me, hey, let's turn this into a real thing. Let's turn this into a real project. Let's turn this into a real company, and let's give it a good name. And let's not.
That was his first priority.
Yeah. No, he Anil is very, very good at being like, this is a good project. We're going to change the name. we're going to change how you talk about it and what it does. And he said, let's expand it to other networks beyond Twitter. So this side project and you know, the Twitterlytic code literally from the beginning was like copy and pasted from the O'Reilly book. I think it was called like Twitter API, cracking the Twitter API. It was their introductory Twitter API book. So for all of you learning how to code who are, you know, starting projects from tutorials, like that's where ThinkUp started, from a tutorial, from a how-to book, and then turned into a company. So that was how that happened.
So ThinkUp basically pulled from different social media networks and use their APIs to give you insight into your online presence. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah. It pulled you. So you signed up for ThinkUp and you connected your Twitter account, your Facebook account, and your Instagram account. And it would give you insights into what your friends were talking about, how what tweets of yours got the most replies, the most retweets, the most favorites, what domains you link to the most, when your friends change their Twitter or their Facebook profile description, if they change their avatar. A lot of these features predated Twitter's now available to everyone analytics. Mm-hmm.
Which took them forever to do, by the way.
It took them a really long time, and it felt like this hole in the market. And you know, at the time when I started first using or building Twitterlytic, Twitter didn't even thread replies, so you couldn't like go to a tweet and then see all the replies you know that came after it. That didn't exist then.
That must have created so many more Twitter fights. Just having no context for where the tweet came from.
It's true. It's so true. I mean, who knows? I mean, all the tweets are in the Library of Congress now. I don't know. I'm sure tweets been back then, like completely no context. So that was one of the features that I built, is like, I just want to be able to ask a question on Twitter, like, hey, what's the, you know, what image editor are people using on the Mac right now? And be able to compile the responses to those. You know, for things like a Lifehacker post or, you know, an article I was writing. I was really using Twitter as like a research tool. And so that's one of the original features of Twitterlytic. So a lot of the features of Twitterlytic and then ThinkUp kind of became built into Twitter and the other platforms as well over time. But we really tried to take a unique angle on it, and we wrote a lot of kind of copy around the insights that was kind of fun and lighthearted, and we focused really much, very much on the individual versus like say a brand trying to get stats about the Twitter population as a whole. This ThinkUp is about you and your network.
So for a product like that, who would be your audience?
So our audience was primarily independent kind of creators, podcasters, Etsy sellers, YouTube stars, comedians, writers, bloggers, individual people who were kind of actively working on building their audience, but not in like a smarmy, you know, buy 10,000 followers kind of way.
In a real way.
Genuine way, by interacting with people, by paying attention. Oh, you change your bio. I see that you change jobs, or, you know, nice, I love your hair and your avatar, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And you know, people who wanted to see which tweets of mine were resonating the most or images or Facebook posts. And so it turns out that market is very small compared to sort of the Twitterverse and, you know, as a whole.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I remember when I first read about ThinkUp a while, I think over a year ago for sure, I was looking at, you know, what you all did, and I thought, this is really cool, but it also feels really risky because you're building a product based on what other tech companies are willing to give you in terms of data, right? And what their API will allow. And I know there's lots of other companies that, you know, Tweetbot is a pretty well-known one. And, you know, there's a bunch of other ones that are very much dependent on other companies giving them access. And that's a problem that you kind of ended up running into.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, over the years that I ran ThinkUp, I saw so many of the companies whose APIs we were very dependent on change and change kind of for the worse for us. So in 2009, Twitter's API was so open and so accessible to even, you know, the least, you know, very inexperienced programmers. I mean, literally, it would just be one command in your terminal and you could get a list of tweets. And over time, it started to close down and there were certain rules and there was throttling and it got more complicated and they threw up OAuth. And similar thing at Facebook, where, you know, the API was very open and then, you know, privacy concerns and rules and, okay, no, you can't get this data. You have to request this data. You have to get approved in order to have this access. And, you know, in some ways, I think that some of those changes, I think, were good for users. And some of those changes, I think, were because, you know, these companies had products, they didn't want third-party products duplicating their feature set. So it was constantly a race. There was building Think Up the product and making it better and adding features, but there was always this sort of maintenance task of keeping up with the API rules and making sure we were approved and making sure we weren't running afoul of any terms of services. In fact, we launched with our payment, when we launched the software as a service, which was like the hosted ThinkUp where somebody could come and subscribe and say, okay, for $5 a month, I want to get these insights every day. We used the Amazon Payments payment method because we thought, well, everyone has an Amazon account and we don't want people to have to, you know, type in their credit card numbers. It'll just be really easy to say pay with Amazon. Mm-hmm. And then like a year in, Amazon's like, yeah, we're discontinuing that. So,
thanks, Amazon.
You know, here's our new payments program. It's just that all of your users have to come back and repay. You know, so we saw it with the networks as well as just something as simple as just our payment structure. So yeah, it hit us hard. The dependency on those APIs hit us hard and the changes to those APIs definitely slowed us down and kept us very busy with work that was invisible to users.
Mm. And so recently ThinkUp announced that it was going to shut down.
Yes.
Did you see that coming?
Well, we did. My co-founder Anil Dash and I did see, we didn't see the shutdown coming. We saw that we had a product that we were proud of and it had a solid but not huge user base. The people who loved it, who used it, loved it, and we really appreciate that. But our user base was not growing at the rate it needed to grow in order for us to sort of ramp up on revenue the way that we needed to for a company in order to continue to enhance the product. So we could see that our growth was flat, which is usually a bad sign for a company. And then on top of the growth being flat, Instagram made a bunch of changes to their API, which have been difficult for us to adjust to. And he and I, my co-founder and I, sat down and we had a heart-to-heart. And we said, you know, how is this going? Where are we going with this? Even if we make these fixes for the Instagram API changes, we're not seeing the revenue growth that we need. We're just barely keeping this thing up and running. The right thing to do for our customers is to give them their money back, tell them that, you know, we tried and it didn't work out, and thank them for their support. So it was a few different factors. User growth not being as high as it needed to be, the main factor, but also the work of the APIs. And just kind of like we could see the writing on the wall, like, oh, this is going to get more and more difficult. Like these APIs are just becoming more and more shut down or closed off rather than becoming more open.
How did it feel to make that decision and kind of, you know, to a degree, admit defeat to your users who really loved your product?
Oh, it was awful. It was terrible. I felt like a huge failure. Anil is very, very, you know, sort of ruthlessly optimistic about this, so I think that his take would be different. But for me, it was very difficult. You know, Lifehacker was this very big success for me relatively early in my career, and it's the thing that people know me for the most. And so starting my own company, which I hadn't done with Lifehacker, ThinkUp was the first company that I had started, felt like this tremendous risk. And I know intellectually that most startups fail. And I know intellectually that user growth is hard. And I know intellectually that people don't really pay for things on the web unless you're Netflix on a monthly subscription basis. I knew that, but I was still, as a founder, kind of has to be, you have to be kind of, you know, absurdly optimistic, mm-hmm. right? Because if you don't believe that you can do it, then you're starting off on the wrong foot. So I believe that we could do it. I believe that the product was going to be so good that we were going to defeat all those odds, and we didn't. And so making that decision was very, very difficult. I felt like a huge failure, and I spent a good part of the beginning of this year, so we're in July now, 2016. I would say it's the first 4 or 5 months of 2016, like really grieving before we even really communicated this to our customers. Just grieving and feeling like a failure because from a capitalistic point of view, the business failed. And so I had to do a lot of thinking about, you know, what did that mean? You know, this thing that I did didn't work out. Why didn't it work out? What could I have done differently? Does this mean that I'm a failure or just this thing I did was a failure? Yeah, it was a lot of meditation and definitely a lot of grieving and also just letting go of a thing I had poured several years of my life into.
So how did you end up coping with that? Because we're here, we're talking about it. You seem at this point very, you know, comfortable and candid reflecting on that. What helped you get through that part so you can move on and move on to your next adventure?
You know, it was a lot of self-care. So running your own startup, I think for me anyway, one of the first things to go was sleeping well and mm-hmm. eating well and exercising and, you know, practicing sort of positive self-talk, just writing every day, keeping a work journal and keeping a personal journal, eating a good breakfast. All those things had really gone out the window for me because my life was just like, make this company work, make sure I'm there for my family. And everything was really nonstop. So, you know, when I hit this place, I was like, oh, this isn't going to work out. And I feel terrible, not only emotionally, but like physically, I feel terrible because I haven't been taking care of myself. I was like, okay, I got to turn this around. The only way that I'm going to process this is I'm going to form better habits. I'm going to spend some time to give myself some time. Again, this is really a privilege that I have because I have a partner who's employed. I'm going to give myself some time to process this and to take care of myself and to write a lot and to read a lot and just reflect and come to a peace of like, I tried this thing. It didn't work out. And now where do I go from here?
How has that experience influenced how you build products now and how you choose, you know, different APIs and gems and libraries to include in your work?
You know, I haven't worked on much. Well, I shouldn't say that. So during the time that it was becoming clear ThinkUp wasn't growing and Anil and I were facing that, he had this idea for a thing he wanted to build, which would be like an IMDb for creators and their projects. And so as a way to make ourselves feel better about what was going on with life with ThinkUp, we decided to build this thing, and it's called MakerBase, and it was something that we launched. It's makerbase.co. And it is a completely brand new from the ground up. It's basically a social network. Like, you sign up and you enter your projects. And it does connect to the Twitter API, but it is not dependent upon the Twitter mm-hmm. API.
There you go.
And you don't have to pay to use it. And, you know, it's a very different product, very, very different product from ThinkUp. And that was really cathartic. And it was really, really cool to see the user sign-up numbers be a lot faster and a lot better for MakerBase. And it was nice to see that we didn't have to constantly make updates to it for API. So that was the main product that I built after ThinkUp. And I think a lot of that for Anil and me was a reaction to what we did with ThinkUp because it was very different. Although it was still mm-hmm. a web app. And ThinkUp too was just a purely web app, which we think in some ways, you know, worked against us. So yeah, I mean, the experience with ThinkUp is certainly something I'm going to take with me going forward. That said, you know, so many products really have to, for practicality reasons, be dependent on other APIs. Yeah, I mean, for example, I'm never going to build credit card processing myself. I'm just never going to do it. It's just not a project that it doesn't make any sense to build that in-house, for particularly for a small company. I'm always going to go with something like Stripe or probably Stripe at this point, but, you know, all the different options. And Stripe could change, and that's something that, you know, you have to kind of have a resilience for. Like, this is a problem that doesn't just go away. You can't just develop in a vacuum. You can't say, well, I can't depend on any APIs, so I'm going to build everything myself from scratch. That's not reasonable, but I think that you can kind of try to future-proof yourself as much as possible within reason when you make those decisions.
So as a code newbie, just getting into APIs, learning how to, you know, use different integrations and different things, what advice would you have on when it might make more sense to kind of tough it out and build your own thing, roll your own, and when it's a better decision to use something off the shelf?
you know, it's so dependent on your particular situation and what you're building. I mean, I think that today in 2016, the fact is that things get shared and talked about and looked at on social. So there has to be some sort of social component to your app if you're looking for user growth and you're looking for viral growth and you're looking for people to share it and talk about it. I think that, I think it really kind of depends on your situation. You can't build in a vacuum, but you have to at least be really aware of the risks if you decide to go full on a particular platform.
And I think that's one of the things that is hard to find out, right? So if you're planning on using, for example, the Instagram API, how would you know that Facebook might change it so dramatically that it ruin some of your key functionality? You know, and maybe that's a situation where it's really helpful to know about the history of Facebook and how it's dealt with APIs in the past, and that there have been any other issues, and kind of use that context to guide your decision. But I think part of what makes it just difficult for newer coders to figure out, well, what are the different factors I should consider, and what are the different variables I should think about to help me make that decision?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it is just kind of educating yourself kind of about the history of the company and the changes that have been made in the past and the things that that company wants to see built, and the things that they kind of don't want to see built. And, you know, it's kind of like reading the tea leaves, like reading the blog posts, and like, okay, what are they talking, what are they encouraging? Like at their developer conference, what are they asking, what are they asking for from developers? What do they want developers to do? And what are the things that they're not really mentioning? I mean, this is tough, right? Because, you don't want to like, I mean, I've seen so many products get built and then they just get built into, if they're really good products, that those features just get built into that you know, the big company's offering. You know, good ideas get cannibalized or worked in all the time. And there's so many things that kind of derail your project. But you can, it's kind of looking at the platforms, figuring out where is there a hole? Is this something that they would approve? I mean, now there's really an approval process. I mean, Twitter hasn't enacted an approval process, but like for Facebook and Instagram, you have to submit an application. Here's my app. Here's what it does. In Instagram's case, I think you have to submit a screencast demo, and they'll approve it or not.
Oh, wow.
So it's pretty clear whether or not, you know, at this moment in time, they'll let you, you know, do what you're doing. It's really locked down to that point. So, I mean, that's a very clear indicator. So I guess it is kind of clearer now. But yeah, I mean, it's really just making a guess. I mean, you're hedging your bets, particularly if you're starting a company based on a product. Like, you're taking a bet and you're taking a risk. But getting as informed and educated as possible is the only approach.
And I feel like that's a good reminder that as developers, we can't afford to just be heads down in our code all the time. We have to look up and see, you know, the larger, the bigger picture. We have to understand what direction the market is going in and what technologies are becoming more popular, less popular. What are some of the, you know, the politics around what different businesses are doing? You know, it helps to have that context as we make product decisions.
Definitely. Definitely. I think as engineers, I think we really can, I know that I really emphasized, you know, just the code. Look at this thing I can make it do. Mm-hmm. And, you know, through my career, I really had to learn like, oh, marketing matters.
Yeah.
You know, it's not all BS. It matters. And knowing people matters. Like understanding what these companies want matter. Like understanding how the ecosystem is right now and what direction things are going. Like it matters because it'll trip you up later.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's really when you're learning to code, especially when you get really deep into code. And I know a lot of coders who are so deep in engineering, they're like, I just don't want to have to deal with any of that stuff. I don't want to deal with the business side. I don't want to deal with marketing. I just want to write code. And that's fine. That's a fine decision. But I think when you're in a founder or entrepreneurial role, you have to kind of keep an eye on lots of different aspects of it, not just the coding aspect.
Mm-hmm. And now I feel like you get to focus even more on the coding aspect with your new job, Director of Engineering at Postlight.
Yeah, I'm really, really lucky to have this position. So Postlight is a digital agency, relatively new digital agency here in New York City. It was founded in October, I think, of last year, so not even a year old yet. And it's about a 40-person company. About a third of us are remote in the U.S. And I'm a director of engineering there. I think I have three have a team of 3 engineers reporting to me right now. And we build apps and websites and tech platforms for clients. So, you know, I like to say we're like Mad Men, but not advertising for digital stuff.
And hopefully nicer.
Yeah. I probably shouldn't say that. I probably shouldn't use the Mad Men reference. Nicer and a lot less sexist. So I've been there for 2 months now.
And how's that been going?
It has been a crash course and so many things. And in client relations, I've never worked for clients in an agency situation where their clients are big companies. In kind of just the politics of a larger organization, I worked in very, very small startups or like kind of on my own at Lifehacker my whole career. So I'm learning how to kind of handle hierarchies and teams and the politics and personalities of working with a very, very smart and talented team there. I'm dealing with a major, and this is something anyone who's learned to code can relate to, just major imposter syndrome of like, whoa, they're doing so much stuff here that I just don't know anything about. I have so much to learn. This is overwhelming. Wow, you know, am I ever going to get there? Of course I will. But it's been really, really great. Really, really fun. It was, you know, I thought that the transition from being a founder to becoming kind of an employee again was going to be rough. I thought that it was going to be difficult. I thought it was going to feel like a demotion. But it hasn't at all. I actually been really enjoying being at a company that is building products that are reaching, you know, just thousands and thousands and hundreds of thousands of people and having impact. Whereas my little small company, which is really cool and independent, you know, wasn't reaching that many people. So there's a lot of power in collaboration, and I've been enjoying that.
Did it end up being a big relief to go back to being an employee from being a founder?
There are lots of things that I don't have to worry about
right
now. I don't have to worry about paying the bills. Yes, exactly. I don't, and in fact, I've been working on shifting my mindset away. Like, I don't have to worry about the whole company's. I don't even have visibility into the entire company's finances, which is both a relief and also very weird. But yeah, it's really nice. Like, health insurance is amazing. you know, just like benefits like that are really nice. But then also there's kind of the bigger, you know, kind of the bigger responsibilities. Like I'm helping out with hiring. We are hiring. Mm-hmm. Just a quick plug, postlight.recruiterbox.com. But I'm getting to interview candidates and like looking at the makeup of our team and how do we build a strong and inclusive and diverse team, and being, you know, kind of in charge of that. We weren't doing very much hiring at ThinkUp because we were just so small. So I didn't have to think on those larger terms that way. So that's been really cool. So it's been both an expansion and a shrinking of responsibilities. That's been really interesting.
And I feel like with the shrinking of responsibilities, you also get to focus more.
Yes.
Because as a founder, you have to think about everything all the time. Everything feels very urgent, very, you know, just critical to the mission. But when you get to be an employee, you get to focus on doing your job and doing it really, really well, which must be really nice.
Yeah, it is nice. It is really nice to be able to dig deep on things and to have support and to be able to turn to somebody next to me and say, what do you think about this? And it is good. I really liked the part of being a founder, of being a generalist and in one given day, you know, running a database script and, you know, doing some promotion and then writing blog posts, you know, marketing and copy and doing all those different things. I did like that part of being a founder, but now, I mean, I do have several different roles at Postlight, but I do get to dig deeper on each one because I don't have to worry about those other things. So that's been really nice.
That's the end of part one of our interview with Gina Trapani. Next week, we'll talk to her about what she looks for when hiring a new developer and what it's like to interview at Postlight. And they are hiring, so make sure to listen to part two of this interview. And don't forget to join us this Wednesday at 9 p.m. Eastern Time for our weekly Code Newbie Twitter chat. Just search for hashtag Code Newbie and tweet with us every Wednesday night at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. You can learn more about that as well as show notes on this episode at codenewbie.org/podcast. If there's a topic you want to hear about or a guest you want to hear from, send us an email, hello@codenewbie.org. Thank you so much for listening. See you next week.